Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder and president of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. A man I've had the privilege of serving with for a long time in that war is one of our country's best communicators, particularly when it comes to matters involving national security and the importance of preserving it. He is Clifford May. These days, he is the founder and president of the Foundation for the Defense of Democracies, served in a variety of other capacities, however, over the years, notably in the Fourth Estate as a reporter for the New York Times. He writes the Foreign Desk column at the Washington Times. Cliff May, it's always a pleasure to have you on this program. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Frank. Good to be with you.
Again, give us sort of a 30,000-foot perspective on the practical consequences and sort of pattern, if you will, of behavior of President Obama in pursuit of his foreign policy legacy. This is much on our minds as he travels about Asia at the moment, the Vietnam business with arms sales and Hiroshima coming up. But put it into the larger context, if you would, Cliff.
Well, sure. In the larger context, you know, Valerie Jarrett, who is his very close advisor, was recently asked this question. She said, well, President Obama ended two wars. I found that just astonishing and striking at a time when the war in Afghanistan is continuing, not going terribly well, although the leader of the Taliban was recently brought to his final justice in Baluchistan, part of Pakistan. That's a positive development. It doesn't end the war by any means, but the point is that in Afghanistan, the war continues. And in Iraq, after, I think, very precipitously and prematurely removing our troops in 2011, which has led to such things as the rise of the Islamic State, we now have something like 5,000 troops back there because the war in Iraq continues, at least in parts of Iraq, in Fallujah right now, which is about 30 or 40 miles from the capital of Baghdad, and well into Syria. So I don't think he has succeeded at that at all. I think he has misunderstood. I think Trotsky's quip applies to him. You may not be interested in war, but war may be interested in you. Now, in terms of the pivot to Asia, we haven't seen a lot come of it, although the most important thing recently is the lifting of the arms embargo on Vietnam. That's controversial for a number of reasons and should be, but I certainly understand it, although I don't think old President Obama has explained it with any candor. I think the reason is that Vietnam is trying to stand up to China, which has very clear hegemonic ambitions for that area of the world, and perhaps beyond over time. And we want them to be able to stand up to China because the alternative is for them to kowtow to China and let China become what it wants to be, the Colossus of Asia.
I think that's true. And I think it also provides kind of a pretext in a way, Cliff May, for the president doing what he is very much want to do, as you know, and that is treat our adversaries, actual or former perhaps, rather better than he treats our friends. And I'm thinking of the Russian reset, for example. I'm thinking of the Iran deal, which you were very, very sharply critical of, and rightly so. I'm thinking of the Cuba normalization. And now this with the Vietnamese. This really raises the question of whether or not, if you do reward your friends less well than you do your enemies, you're not likely to wind up with more enemies than friends. What do you think?
I think that's a fair analysis. I think President Obama came into office with an idea that's been proven wrong, but not proven wrong to his satisfaction, and that is that most of the conflicts and disputes in the world were due to either misunderstandings or could be resolved if the United States would simply recognize the legitimacy of various grievances and take steps to address those grievances in a spirit of compromise and sympathy. And so you had the reset with Russia because theoretically, in his view, there was nothing separating us from Vladimir Putin. And in terms of Iran, he thought could be a very, and still does believe, can be a, a responsible and legitimate player in that part of the world. He recently said that the people that Iran and Saudi Arabia should share the region. There's something of Mr. Rogers to that kind of doctrine
in the neighborhood. That's right. And Cliff, you know, you've been, as I say, very actively engaged in this Iran debate, and I think you're struck by the spectacle of the Secretary of State, who helped craft this dubious product, is now flacking actively for the Europeans to open their banking system and otherwise to do business with the Iranians. Again, is this not likely to embolden the very worst of those in Iran rather than bring about the kind of transformation that you say the president continues to cling to?
I think it's not just likely. I think it's inevitable. I think anybody who has studied history knows that when you have such enemies as you do in the Islamic Republic of Iran, attempts at appeasement do not satisfy their appetites. Rather, they whet those appetites. And we've seen that, and we're seeing that time and again. And we did have the great deception that was put forward by Ben Rhodes and the Obama administration that essentially moderates were challenging hardliners in Iran, and we could support those moderates and have a very different Iran in the near future. That was never the case. What's more, the intelligence community never believed for a second that was the case. And Leon Panetta, who, among other things, was the head of the CIA, told that to David Samuels for that now famous piece in the New York Times magazine. Keep in mind that you have people criticizing the Bush administration because they said it cherry-picked intelligence. Nobody ever said they ignored and rejected intelligence entirely and had their own view based on nothing substantive, no evidence whatsoever. We now know that there never was. A moderate faction. There are factions, but not moderate factions, and certainly we haven't helped them in any way.
Hey, Cliff, May, one of the things that came out of that rather remarkable account of this fiction writer's role in crafting American foreign policy was the, well, very candid condemnation of the community in which you long worked, namely the journalistic community. What did you make of that? Was he unfair in his characterization of these as a bunch of 27-year-old know-nothings? But whether he was or whether he wasn't, do you think that he was actually able to play that community like a Stradivarius in connection with selling the Iran deal?
He was able to play that community. He's not the first to attempt to try to play that community. And from the White House, it's not hard to do it successfully. People will do a lot in order to maintain their access. What struck me as particularly strange is his title, which reflects his role. He was deputy advisor on national security for strategic communications. And in the past, there has always been an appropriate separation between those who make policy and those who market policy, so that a James Carville might have had too much influence, but he wasn't actually making the policy. Karen Hughes might have had too much to say. She wasn't. But you never had somebody in the role of a sort of Henry Kissinger who was mainly a PR guy and a fiction writer. You melded these two in a very strange way, and I don't think it's productive.
You've spent a lot of time at the Foundation for Defense of Democracies defending one of our most important democratic allies, the State of Israel. I wondered if you had seen the piece that Brett Stevens has in the Wall Street Journal today about a talk of a coup in Israel. I don't know what to make of this. I've never heard of such a thing, and wondered if this come across your desk.
Yeah, I certainly read Brett's piece, and it's contrarian and very interesting. You had a lot of people who have been very critical of Netanyahu for switching from a rather experienced guy as his defense minister to someone who is much less experienced, but that has to do with internal Israeli politics and trying to broaden his coalition, which has been razor thin and now will have a little bit of strategic depth. I think Brett is always worth paying attention to, and I do think he is right that the military in Israel, which oddly tends to be to the left of the political establishment that gets voted in, probably overstepped its bounds. And I don't think that's the only reason Netanyahu did what he did. Again, I think he has other reasons to try to have a more stable government that won't get a vote of non-confidence anytime soon. He needs to be able to plan. I get all that. But I guess I would end up by saying I found Brett's piece very interesting, very provocative, and probably pretty persuasive.
Yeah. We'll watch it closely as we do your work at the Foundation for Defense of Democracies. Cliff May, thanks for joining us. It's always good to talk with you. Let's do it again soon. Peter Husey joins us next to take stock a little bit on Iran and nuclear deterrence and more straight ahead.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney.
If you listen to this radio station a lot, you may have noticed our brand new name. It's got a catchy ring to it. But there's more than that. The name actually tells you who we are and what we do in one word. It took us a while to come up with this, but we realized if there's one thing we want to be to DC listeners, it was this. We want to be your answer to everything, to what happened while you slept, to why am I stuck in traffic, to how do you get control of this country again. Big stuff and little stuff. This may be a tall order for one radio station, but we know we're up for it. AM 1260, The Answer.
Hi, I'm Tim McGraw. The men and women of the Air Force Reserve play a vital role in protecting us at home and abroad. They are your neighbors, whose dedication to our country and commitment to their communities call them to serve. Dedication, commitment, and service. It happens every day at home and around the world. They're your neighbors, making a difference.
Joel Klein catches a 7 o'clock train after his evening CPR class at the American Red Cross.
Ron Garrity's on the same train. He's had a rough day and doesn't feel like himself. Until he feels the sudden tightness in his chest, Ron never thought he'd actually have a heart attack.
Until Joel is administering CPR, he never thought he'd actually save a life.
When you train with the Red Cross, you change a life.
Starting with your own.
Call 1-800-RED-CROSS or visit redcross.org to learn about life-changing opportunities in your area.
Hi, this is Frank Gaffney. My day job is running the Center for Security Policy, which each weeknight brings you this program. But Secure Freedom Radio is just one of the important contributions the Center makes to the common defense. We call our team the Special Forces in the War of Ideas. Like the real Special Forces, we strive to be agile, creative, and highly effective in identifying threats to our country and how they might best be countered. We can't do all this without you, though. Also, like the real Special Forces, ours need ammunition. And in the war of ideas, ammo is money. The Center is a nonprofit, tax-exempt organization. Contributions to its work are tax-deductible and an important investment in your security and freedom. Find out more about the Center for Security Policy and how you can help keep its Special Forces team in the fight by visiting securefreedom.org. Many thanks.
There are many sounds in your daily life. Ones that make you smile. Ones that help you relax. And there are some sounds that can help save lives. Wireless emergency alerts, now on many mobile devices, use a unique sound and vibration to bring you critical information about emergencies in your area. With updates from local sources you know and trust, you can be in the know wherever you are. Learn more at ready.gov/alerts. Brought to you by FEMA and the Ad Council.
Ready to roll?
Go for it.
Hi, I'm Jessie Jane Duff. I'm a retired United States Marine Corps Gunnery Sergeant, and I served 20 years on active duty serving this great country. I'm with Concerned Veterans for America now. After I got off active duty, I realized I still wanted to be involved and help change the direction our country is going. Concerned Veterans for America offered me that great opportunity. If you want to get involved and you're thinking of getting involved, please visit our website because we have many activities throughout the nation. We have wonderful representatives in each state who are putting forward different ways you can become engaged. So go to the website at concernedveteransforamerica.org, and you do not have to be a veteran. But if you support the freedoms that we all fought so hard for to defend this great nation, then consider participating in the many activities we are participating in and helping to change the direction our country is going.
You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
welcome back. We are joined by Peter Husey, a man that I think can only be described as a national security impresario. He has just celebrated the 1400th event that he has conducted in various fora, almost all of them with senior national security policy practitioners, both past and present, and in so doing has rendered a real service, particularly to the Washington community, to help expose people to the important work that is still needed to protect this country from enemies, foreign and domestic. He is, among other things, the president of Geostrategic Analysis and a contributor mightily through his writings to publications like National Review, Human Events, National Interest, Family Security Matters, and more. Always welcome here. Peter, good to have you. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Frank.
You've written a paper that I think will be published shortly about a very serious problem, Peter, and that is the threat posed by Iranian terrorism, likely to be greatly enhanced, the prospect of it certainly, by the billions of dollars flowing their way now. Give us a sense, particularly what this might mean in the Persian Gulf, the Strait of Hormuz, and to American personnel in the region.
Thank you, Frank. Recently, the head of the Iranian Navy said that they would close the Straits of Hormuz unless the United States showed them respect. And that's code for doing what we want you to do on the Iranian quote-unquote deal. And most analysts in response dismissed the Iranian threat because the U.S. Navy was considered strong enough, of course, to keep the Straits open. What's interesting is if you go back to 2002, we did a war game. The United States did a war game, and they hired a retired three-star Marine general to be the Iran team, the Red Team. And he closed the straits, and our Navy couldn't open them. And they used a lot of unconventional capabilities, including swarming attacks with small boats. They didn't use electronic communications, so we couldn't eavesdrop on what they were saying. And during that period of time, from 2002 to today, Iran has a lot better ballistic missiles of much greater range, so that the area in which they can put at risk is much wider than it used to be. And the Navy's got a problem in that we don't have as many ships, and we have some real maintenance and operational problems where the Heritage Foundation says that of the 10 carriers, we have 5 that might be useful and maybe 2 at work.
Peter Husey is our guest. We're talking with him about Iran and the threat that it poses to American shipping and personnel in the Persian Gulf. And Peter, you're talking about sort of the declining numbers of our ships at a moment when Iranian capabilities are rising. How serious a problem is that, particularly with respect to our carriers?
Well, one of the things I saw at Mr. Johnson over the Heritage Foundation, who used to work on Capitol Hill and the Armed Services Committee, laid out that of the 10 carriers, 4 are potentially available if we do certain things, but not day-to-day. The only ones available are 2 day-to-day. So the Navy Times did an article recently where they said there are gaps in where our carrier task forces will be, and these gaps are unprecedented in that if you and I know from our Cold War history, and certainly even after the Cold War, we always had a carrier in certain parts of the world, particularly in the Mediterranean, Middle East, the Western Pacific. That's at risk. And one of the reasons is the operation and maintenance accounts. As you know, in the Pentagon, when you cut money, that's the easiest place to find money, because you cut a dollar, you get a dollar, as opposed to development money or procurement money, where you take out a dollar in authority and you get maybe 20 cents back. So they, in the previous 6-7 years where we have cut dramatically out of the budget, O&M has been hurt. As you know, in the Air Force, according to the Chief of Staff of the Air Force, 46% of our airplanes can't fly. I was reading an article just yesterday that 70% of our Marine Corps aircraft are not able to fly because of lack of spare parts and maintenance.
We're going to be talking with Carl Higbee, a Navy SEAL, about some of the problems with the United States military in a moment, Peter. But this is a very chilling treatment of the problem, and I fear it is, again, something that most Americans are oblivious to, and the dangerous world in which we find ourselves makes that all the more reckless. Peter, let me turn to another area in which you're deeply knowledgeable and, again, I think are trying to shed light on a problem most of us are unaware of, and that is with respect to our nuclear deterrent. As part of your breakfast series, you've recently had 2 prominent figures in this space, an old colleague of mine, Franklin Miller from Pentagon days, And the deputy commander of the Strategic Forces Command, Lieutenant General Stephen Wilson, would you give us a sense of the kinds of concerns those gentlemen have been expressing?
Well, I was fascinated by both their remarks, and it came down to we have reduced our nuclear deterrent warheads by 90% since the first reductions agreement under President Reagan and President Bush, the START one. We have tried to keep the number of platforms up. They're a little around 500 right now when you add up all the subs, bombers, ICBMs. And we have not had as much luck in terms of modernizing the force, which Reagan was doing, which was building down as you modernized. So you had better forces and more modern, but you reduced. We're reducing, and our force modernization will be, we'll start it when the Russians are finished theirs. So when the New York Times says there's an arms race, they got it backwards. There's only one country, two countries racing. It's called China and Russia. And Russia will complete its entire nuclear modernization program before we put a new bomber, a new submarine, or a new ICBM in the business, which won't happen until 2028. The Russians will be done in 2022. So that's what the real problem is.
And what does that mean for deterrence, Peter? Does that suggest that we're on a kind of, minimal deterrent posture? Or is it, at the very least, one that's becoming more asymmetric by the day?
Well, both Frank and General Wilson pointed out that if one proposal that's being made by the left, by the arms control, the anti-nuke people, is let's get rid of land-based missiles, which out of, it's about a $42 billion program over the next 20 years. And that would reduce, as Frank Miller says, you would reduce the number of targets the Russians have to worry about from over 500 to less than 10. In fact, he said 6. And Ron Lehman, former ambassador who was our chief negotiator under Reagan for 4 years on nuclear weapons with Russia, pointed out that it's under 10 for sure, but what it basically says is a country like North Korea that has, this is what Senator General Wilson said, the Chinese say North Korea has 10 warheads. With those 10 warheads alone, the North Koreans could put us out of the nuclear business. Why in the name of God would we do that? It's my boss here. It's crazy.
Yeah, let me just be clear. There would remain at sea some number of submarine-based missiles, and therefore that deterrent would be hopefully less than completely neutralized. But how serious a problem would North Korea be, let alone the Russians or Chinese?
This is what General Wilson said. If you go down to the minimal deterrent, which the Plowshares Group and, the New Global Zero is
help bring us the nuclear deal with Iran, by the way.
Yes, thank you. And you're talking about 6 subs at sea and at port altogether, maybe 8 at the most. You're talking about 3 at sea, maximum, maybe 2 at sea. So you have 2 submarine bases at best. You have 2 bomber bases at best. That's it. That's 4. And you have 2 subs at sea. That's 6. If you find your subs at sea, then you basically, you don't even have to use nuclear weapons. But if you use nuclear weapons against the bases to wipe them out, which would effectively wipe them out for sure. As General Wilson pointed out, you are putting North Korea in a position of being a peer competitor. Now, you may not be doing it on purpose, but that is the result of going to such low levels of platforms and this mania to go to lower levels of nuclear weapons, which is what's driving all this.
This is not good for deterrence. This is not good for the security of the United States, for sure. Peter, I have to wrap. Unfortunately, we are hard out of time, but we will come back for a further discussion of all of this with you. In the meantime, thanks for the good work you do with your breakfasts and lunches and dinners, and also, of course, at Geostrategic Analysis. Take care, my friend. Next up, Carl Higbee, Navy SEAL, right after this.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney.
People from around the country have no clue what we're like here in Washington, D.C. Yeah, we've got our whack jobs like the guy who climbed the fence and walked around the White House. We have the people who see the black helicopters. But there's one common denominator for all of us, friends and family. And there's no place where relationship means more than it does right here. Yeah, we may be famous for the dignitaries, but friends and family, that makes us tick. And frankly, this radio station gets that. That's why I listen. AM 1260, The Answer.
Hi, this is Frank Gaffney. My day job is running the Center for Security Policy, which each weeknight brings you this program. But Secure Freedom Radio is just one of the important contributions the Center makes to the common defense. We call our team the Special Forces in the War of Ideas. Like the real Special Forces, we strive to be agile, creative, and highly effective in identifying threats to our country and how they might best be countered. We can't do all this without you, though. Also, like the real Special Forces, ours need ammunition. And in the War of Ideas, ammo is money. The Center is a nonprofit, tax-exempt organization. Contributions to its work are tax-deductible and an important investment in your security and freedom. Find out more about the Center for Security Policy and how you can help keep its Special Forces team in the fight by visiting securefreedom.org. Many thanks.
This is Frank Affney with the Secure Freedom Minute. President Obama is obsessed with repudiating America's Cold War policies. He has vainly sought to reset relations with Russia's anti-U.S. dictator, struck a terrible deal with Iran in part as compensation for CIA involvement in a coup there long ago, and provided political legitimacy and economic life support to Cuba's still hostile Stalinist regime. Now, Mr. Obama is using shared concerns about Chinese militarism as cover for yet another repudiation of past American stances by allowing communist Vietnam access to U.S. weapon systems. In this case, the misplaced priority Team Obama gives to helping Cold War enemies is showcased by the fact that pro-U.S. nations no less in Beijing's crosshairs than Vietnam, like Taiwan and the Philippines, are not receiving such presidential attention or help with their defenses, showing it again that under Obama, it's better to be America's foe than its friend. This is Frank Gaffney.
This is Fred Fleitz with the Center for Security Policy. According to the New York Times, President Obama said during a rare visit to the CIA to discuss the second phase in the battle against ISIS on April 13th, that the U.S.-led coalition had momentum against ISIS and that ISIS fighters realize their cause is lost. But the previous day, the New York Times ran a story with the headline, ISIS expands reach despite military and financial setbacks, noting that although ISIS has suffered losses on the ground in Iraq and Syria, it has expanded its presence in northern Africa, Afghanistan, and Europe. There also has been little progress in stopping ISIS's efforts to recruit homegrown terrorists worldwide. The president is in denial about the threat from ISIS. His trip to the CIA, which should have occurred 5 years ago when the violence broke out in the Middle East, was little more than a publicity stunt. I'm Fred Fleitz. Learn more at securefreedom.org.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
We're back. We're joined, I'm very pleased to say, by Carl Higbee, a former Navy SEAL with combat experience in Iraq during Operation Iraqi Freedom. The author of two terrific books, a bestseller entitled Battle on the Home Front, and most recently, a new one with a title that I particularly love, Enemies Foreign and Domestic, A SEAL's Story. Carl Higbee is a man you perhaps have seen of late in connection with his role as a spokesman for Donald Trump's campaign. But we're delighted to have him here to talk a bit about his new book and some of his insights into the state of the U.S. military. Carl Higbee, I appreciate your sacrifice as well as your service greatly, and I'm delighted to have a chance to talk with you. Thanks for joining us.
Well, thank you very much for having me on.
Well, your story, I guess, focuses primarily on a bit of classic SEAL derring do concerning a man that's come to be known as the Butcher of Fallujah, and what flowed from his capture. Give us, if you would, a quick sort of depiction of what that story entails and what flowed from it.
So, this was an operation that we went out. First off, this guy was very hard to track. He was the most wanted man in Iraq at the time. And we had one of our SEAL junior officers track him and found him, to much the surprise of any of the three-letter agencies that have been looking for him forever. And we tried to get approval, and it was almost impossible to get the approval from our internal chain of command to be allowed to go get this guy. Don't know why. Any event, we go out, we get him.
The reason presumably was because it was a pretty dangerous place to try to go in the belly of Fallujah, right?
Well, I think it was more of the fact that our senior commanders were very risk averse at the time, because that was during the drawdown of Iraq, and they were, the Obama administration was trying to portray an image that the war was over by not letting our troops go get bad guys, so they could say, hey, we're not doing anything over there anymore. The war's over. Problem is the enemy has a say too, and they said the war wasn't over. And so we go out and get the guy. Flawless operation, you know. I had a chance to serve with some of the greatest guys, and I tell you, the guys on this operation executed to the T. I mean, this is the best group of guys I've ever had a chance to work with. And we went out there, we brought him back without a shot fired, flawless, came back. Guy bites his lip, claims we abused him, which is like page one out of the terrorist handbook. And, you know, our commanders, instead of taking our back, they take the terrorists back, and they string us out for what was going to be a general's mast. We subsequently requested court-martial and took him to task over it.
And in the end, they were all exonerated, and you then found yourself getting, as I understand it, from your account in Enemies Foreign and Domestic, flayed again by this sort of Kafkaesque process in your own chain of command. I mean, this must have been unbelievably demoralizing to you and your comrades.
I mean, it was so frustrating. And the American public, they were so annoyed by this whole situation. It's like, you have to ask yourself, what side are you on? I mean, when your troops are coming back from operations that you send them out on, only to be bent by attorneys to make sure they're not going to get strung up on murder or abuse charges, what is happening to our military?
Well, and that's where I wanted to go next with you, Carl Higbee. You've served in uniform in some of the toughest jobs there are, in the most elite unit, arguably, certainly in the Navy. You've got an appreciation, both by virtue of that experience and, of course, what you're doing now on behalf of the Trump campaign, for what's going on with that U.S. military of ours. It is, after all, the only one we've got, and it turns out the world's a pretty dangerous place. We may need it to do a lot of hard things in the future. So give us just a quick assessment, if you would, of morale, of readiness, of leadership within the ranks.
Well, here's the thing is the U.S. soldier is the most lethal weapon the world has ever known, and they are always ready and willing. The problem is giving them the ability to be ready and willing is what we're facing now. We have such an increased scrutiny from the Obama administration on things like rules of engagement, manning, where resources go, will they commit enough resources? I mean, Americans' forces will win anything you put them in. I mean, in the face of any adversity, they will win. But you have to let us. You have to take the handcuffs off. You have to trust that we will win the war, and we will do the right thing. You don't need restrictive rules of engagement. You don't need to hold us down. We don't need the Obama administration going around saying that, you know, ISIS needs jobs, and that'll be the deterrent. We just need to put bullets in bad guys, and the war will be over.
When you think about the sort of policy context in which those rules of engagement, for example, Carl, are being promulgated, do you feel, as do I, that part of this is a function of an attitude towards the bad guys, or at least towards their agenda, Islamic supremacism, for want of a better term, that is in fact getting us to a point where these characters are going to be emboldened by our rules of engagement and conduct, not dissuaded, let alone defeated.
The crazy thing is that they laugh at us. They're chopping our kids' heads off and putting them in shoeboxes and mailing them home to their families and burning people in cages and drowning them. And yet we're sitting here saying that, oh, well, we have to be nice to them. And we can't serve bacon in some high school cafeterias because it's offensive to Muslims. Guess what? We're America. And I think we should start holding regions accountable for this. That's what we did in World War II, which was the last war we won. We went in there and said, oh, Nazi-occupied territory, innocent civilians in there, sorry, too bad. And we reduced them to parking lots, and that's how you win a war.
It's the hard way, and we, of course, have most of the subsequent years tried very hard to avoid collateral damage and civilian casualties and so on. But as you say, that's something that I think our troops are capable of doing without having themselves handcuffed with rules of engagement. But let me just ask you quickly, Carl, we're almost out of time, but about the enemy on the home front. And we've talked a little bit about the policies that are being set here, but let me ask you, as you look at the kind of environment inside the United States, I think there's very little question that some of this sort of policy debacle is a product of the influence of those Islamic supremacists here in the United States, not just our sort of trying to accommodate their demands overseas. As you've looked around, and you mentioned this business about not having bacon in schools, that is just one example of the kind of accommodations that we've been making to these folks. Is it your sense, as a warrior, that the general practice of accommodating the enemy on foreign battlefields has bad results would apply domestically as well?
Absolutely. These people are laughing at us. They're coming here in droves because we're allowing them to. And then they think that, you know, and not all Muslims are bad people. Let's, you know, 10% of Muslims are radicalized by conservative estimates. That's 200 million Muslims that are willing to do harm to Americans. So it's still a large number. So we need to understand that they're using our own tolerance and our own rules of engagement and our own societal faults against ourselves. And ultimately, it's going to be the destruction of us if we don't wise up to it.
I guess what I'm getting at, Carl, is let's just say for the purpose of discussion that there is, in fact, 10% of that population, 200 million maybe, who are genuinely prepared to go blow themselves up or engage in other acts of violent jihad. There's a vastly larger number, nobody knows for sure how much larger, but a vastly larger number that embraces this this doctrine they call Sharia, and that are seeking through more stealthy means in some cases because they don't want to go up against the U.S. military or they don't want to, you know, engage in actual conflict here in the United States so far, but that they're still sort of advancing that larger agenda through these tactics like demanding accommodations. And I agree with you. This isn't all Muslims by any means, but there is some number of them that, whether it's through violence or whether it's through subversion, are about changing this country and defeating us. I don't think there's any doubt about it. What are your thoughts?
They're not coming here to be a part of the American dream. They're coming here to change it. And I say to them, go back to where you came from. If you're coming to America, come here because you love us and you want to be a part of the culture, not because you want to redefine it.
Well, Carl Higbee, again, thank you for this important new book talking about the challenges you faced in uniform and that we're all facing, frankly, in the face of an enemy that we seem not to understand or certainly be countering effectively, either on foreign battlefields at the moment, no fault of our military, and certainly not domestically. Enemies, Foreign and Domestic, A Seal's Story, your new book. Come back to us again, if you would, very soon, and Godspeed, sir. Good to have you with us. Next up, Gordon Chang joins us. We'll talk about Obama's travels in Asia, what it might mean for you, straight ahead.
Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Every day, the men and women of the United States Marine Corps demonstrate their commitment to defend the American way of life. Since 1775, we have served our nation as a force in readiness.
Get some rear security.
From combat operations to humanitarian assistance in every corner of the world. No matter where the mission takes us today, or wherever our country needs us tomorrow, we always remember the land we call home. As Marines, we take a stand for each other, for our nation, for us all, the few, the proud, the Marines.
Over the past decade, while the American military and intelligence community have been engaged in a kinetic war overseas against a wide array of enemies aligned with the global jihadist movement, the Center for Security Policy has consistently shed light upon a dark and subversive effort that thrives nearly unopposed right here in this country, the one known by the Muslim Brotherhood as Civilization Jihad. In an effort to educate freedom-loving Americans about Civilization Jihad and how it has been waged against every facet of American civilization, the Center for Security Policy has, in 2015, begun publishing a series of monographs called the Civilization Jihad Reader Series. The first of these monographs is entitled Sharia in American Courts, and it documents how Sharia, divine Islamic law, which animates the global jihadist movement, has entered our very own court system. In this study, the Center documents how parties to litigation in American appellate courts have attempted to use Sharia to resolve 146 cases in 32 different states, potentially threatening the constitutional rights of our citizens, particularly women and children. The monograph not only highlights these cases, but the organizations here in America that are actively and successfully working to insinuate Sharia into our judiciary. Finally, it provides information on at least one antidote to this infirmity, a law that has been adopted in 8 states, one that protects our citizens against the use of foreign law and upholds our Constitution as the supreme law of the land, lest those who fight to defend our Constitution overseas do not come home to see it subordinated in a courtroom in their own home state. Learn more by reading Sharia in American Courts, which can be found on Amazon.com or the Center for Security Policy's website at www.securefreedom.org.
Hello, I'm Ace Lyons. As a retired 4-star admiral who served as Commander-in-Chief of the U.S. Pacific Fleet, is a special privilege for me to talk to you about an important new book just released by the Center for Security Policy, China Prepares for Conflict, and Why We Must Do the Same. The book explains that while the Obama administration has dithered over the deterioration of the Middle East and ignored Asia, China has been moving to challenge and displace the dominant role the United States has played in this region and the world since the end of World War II. I am one of 9 co-authors of this important book. The others are former Senator Jim Talent, Gordon Chang, Peter Navarro, Kevin Freeman, Bill Gertz, Frank Gaffney, Fred Flights, and Dean Chang. I explained in my chapter how China's efforts over the last 20 years to seize control of almost the entire South China Sea is an indication of new assertiveness to advance its regional dominance at the expense of the United States. I take issue with President Obama's benign neglect of the threat from China and how Beijing is building islands in the South China Sea that it plans to turn into stationary aircraft carriers to threaten freedom of navigation in this region. Like the other authors of this book, I believe the next president must act immediately to restore American leadership and its military power, both of which have been seriously undermined by the disastrous policies of President Obama. We urgently need to modernize and increase the size of our land, naval, and air forces to stand up to China and other adversaries worldwide. We also need to recognize and counter the growing cyber and intelligence threats from China. The bottom line is that our nation needs to act now. I strongly commend this important book, China Prepares for Conflict and Why We Must Do the Same. You can read it for free as an ebook on the Center's website, securefreedom.org, or you can purchase a copy on Amazon.com.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom, it's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Welcome back. We are pleased to welcome as well Gordon Chang. He has just returned from Asia, where he was, advancing President Obama's trip over there, or at least trying to get the lay of the land before the president arrived. Welcome back, Gordon. It's always good to have you with us, sir.
Thank you so much, Frank. And it's just terrific being back home.
Yeah, I can imagine. Listen, the president, of course, is not. He is in Vietnam at the moment for the second of a 3-day trip there. And then off to other parts. The main focus of it to date has been his decision to undo the previous prohibition on giving the Vietnamese access to our weapons technologies. I gather you think that's a good idea, and I'd like to tease out with you why.
Yeah, lifting the arms embargo is an symbolic step, of course, but it also could have practical implications because we're involved in the struggle of a generation with China. We need all the friends we can get, and the Vietnamese have signaled that they want to work with us. And of course they do because they're threatened by China. So in general, I think that this is a positive step for the United States and for the region as a whole.
One of my misgivings about it is that it seems as though it may have that as a sort of strategic overview or context or pretext, perhaps, Gordon Chang, but it also has to do, as we know from none other than Ben Rhodes, the idea of sort of unraveling old Cold War legacies and policies. And that's not a reason for not doing it. It's just to say that it fits a larger pattern that I think is generally problematic. But I wonder, you are a serious student of these matters, whether this is basically trying to reprise the old China card in the much reviled Cold War, in which we used China as a sort of counterweight to the Soviet Union, now trying to build up the Vietnamese to be something of a counterweight, at least an impediment to Chinese ambitions. Is that basically the play here?
Yeah, I think so. Though, you know, I'd frame it a little bit differently. The United States is not doing this because we want to contain China or because we're trying to balance and be an offshore balancer, as international relations experts would say. We're doing this because China is actually threatening American allies, our friends in the region, and the whole concept of the global commons, which the United States has defended for more than 200 years. The United States doesn't want to be in a confrontational posture with China, but that's where we find ourselves because the Chinese are pushing us that way. And because of that, you know, we're starting to look for friends in the region as friends are starting to look for us in the region. There hasn't been enough leadership there, either in this administration or the previous one. So I see this as a generally positive move on both parts as we're trying to build a coalition to preserve peace and stability.
But let me ask you, Gordon Chang, if that were, in fact, the policy of the United States, would we not be doing a lot more for and with others that are, shall we say, rather more solidly on our side than the Vietnamese have historically been, namely Taiwan and the Philippines, for example?
We should be doing so much more. But, you know, in terms of policies, it's not just this administration. It's previous ones that have been hesitant to deal with China. And regarding Taiwan, I think the United States needs to stand with Taiwan, not only privately, but publicly. And we need to tell the Chinese that we will defend Taiwan. We haven't done that, and clearly we haven't done it since the Eisenhower administration. So this is something that is important for us to do, especially now that China is probably looking for other targets, now that it's being blunted in the South China Sea. I'm sure that it's going to spend much more attention to the East China Sea, specifically Japan and Taiwan, and we need to adjust fast as well, because the Chinese are moving quickly, and they're not just waiting for us to catch up. We're really behind on all of this.
Gordon, you've obviously picked up something in your travels there that I had missed. Have they, the Chinese actually been blunted in the South China Sea, or is that a rhetorical flourish?
Well, I think what's happening right now is that countries are, especially Vietnam, but of course the Philippines as well, you know, have taken a much more resolute policy. We're going to have a new president in the Philippines. We're going to see what Rodrigo Duterte is going to do. But nonetheless, I do think that China realizes there is a coalition, especially now with India sending their ships into the South China Sea, which is going to be a renewed focus of New Delhi. So I'm sure China's looking out there and seeing that, that there's the coalition that they do not like. So, you know, Chinese policy has generally been to shift attention when they've met resistance.
One of the other things you'll be reporting on shortly, I imagine, will be the president's trip to Hiroshima. Give us a preview, if you would, Gordon, as to what you think he's going to say and do there.
The first thing, he's going to the G7, which is going to be very important this year because of some disagreements among the Western democracies on international structure and in currency. But then on Friday, and this will be the focus of the trip, he does go to Hiroshima. He is going to speak. White House has been giving forward guidance that there's going to be no apology, that he will, though, talk about the world without nuclear weapons, and he will do that, of course, in the context of the place where they were first used. A lot of people are going to interpret this in many different ways. Clearly, going there is an implicit apology, and that is going, of course, to stir up old emotions. The United States in no way should apologize for how we ended World War II, because we saved lives, and not just American ones, but Japanese ones as well, because the Japanese military and the political system had made it very clear that they were going to fight to the last person.
I had our colleague Claudia Rosette on the show yesterday, and we talked a bit about this, and she thought just by virtue of this president being who he is and the apologies that he's made in the past, merely by his presence in Hiroshima, there will be that quality to it. We'll watch it, as I say, closely. Gordon, let me turn to one other issue before we have to let you go. In the Wall Street Journal today, there's a report about the Chinese Central Bank. Well, reverting to form, I guess you could say. Maybe it's a bait and switch. But not so long ago, they were talking about ending the practice of currency manipulation, which has been a real serious irritant, as well as a trade problem for us. Have they reversed course on that? And how should we be perceiving what they're up to now?
Yeah, the Chinese Central Bank for several months now has actually been actively intervening to prop up the renminbi, and the Wall Street Journal in this story gives us some of the background and some of the discussions inside the Central Bank and also inside Zhongnanhai, the Communist Party leadership compound, where Xi Jinping has actually been a anti-reformer. China has to do this in a sense, because if they don't, they're going to have more currency outflow and the rest of it. So this is actually an acknowledgement of weakness. But also, we got to remember that IMF Managing Director Christine Lagarde, who has been really the cheerleader for reform in China, trying to help it along, she's been saying that they've been trying to reform their currency. Well, guess what? When push comes to shove, they're not. And so, Christine, if you're listening to this, which I hope you are, because you need to listen to Frank, you should stop. You should not put the renminbi in the special drawing rights basket, because they're actually going back on reform despite all of your hopes and wishes.
You follow these guys so closely. Isn't this really basically just standard operating procedure for China? They made certain representations. They got certain buy-in from friends. They entered as a result into one arrangement or another, the World Trade Organization in the past, for example, now the special drawing rights at the IMF, only to welch on their part of the deal and assume that everybody's going to continue with their sort of approach unchanged. Isn't that basically what we're looking at here?
Absolutely, Frank. This is a pattern which is so well trod. You know, in the past, they were able to do this and get away with it. I'm afraid that they're going to get away with it again. But this is a sign of real weakness on the part of the Chinese currency and the economy as well. So, you know,
unfortunately, on the part of the West, in addition. Gordon, I have to leave it at that. I'm afraid there's so much more to talk with you about. We'll look forward to doing so again next week. In the meantime, welcome home again. Stay well. I hope the rest of you will join us again tomorrow, same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Afty. Thanks for listening.
From the nation's capital, you've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.